All right.
There it is. Hey, you got a clap from Chris Allen. What's happening, everybody? Welcome back and welcome to the Drummers Education Connection. We are here every Tuesday morning on 11 a.m. Pacific time, and we are here to bring you content related to drumming and teaching and education and inspiration. And sometimes we are honored to have legendary drummers on our show, and today is a rare opportunity for us to talk to one of the great legends all time of drumming. Welcome, Mr. Bill Cobham.
Hello, everybody.
Hey. Thank you so much for being part of our show, Bill. This is such an honor. Thank you so, so much.
Well, the pleasure is mine. No problem. I'm glad to have been invited and to take part. No problem.
Beautiful. So we have a lot of younger viewers on our show, and for those of you who are newer to drumming or have been living under a rock for the last 30 years, Bill Cobham is a very important drummer who's influenced a whole generation of drummers who came after him. He played with Horace Silver, Miles Davis, the Brecker Brothers, John McLaughlin, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Stanley Turrentine, Mose Allison, Gene Ammons, George Benson, James Brown, Sonny Rollins, Peter Gabriel, McCoy Tyner, Randy West, and George Duke, and many, many others. That's just a sampling of who Billy has played with. And his career has spanned, 50 years or something like that?
Yeah, somewhere around that, yeah.
And then he's also...
It's safe to say something like
that. He's also had a very successful solo career as a composer and as a leader, and launched, released some very seminal records, Spectrum, Crosswinds, and literally dozens of other albums, many of which have become a really important part of our musical history. So, Bill, thank you so much for coming. Again, we're honored to have you. Let's jump in and let's find out, how did you get started playing drums? How old were you when you got into it?
Ooh, I would say, gotta be around 5 years old. Around 5 years old. I remember drums at home here in Panama. They say I was less than three. Because I left Panama to go to the United States at 3.5 years old in 1947. And I've only returned back here 2005. Mm-hmm. So there's a big gap in the middle. But yeah, that's what I was told by my family. It wasn't unnatural. Many in my family, in the Cobham family, are musicians, music teachers, amongst other things. And so, yeah, I guess that's 5 years old would be about right. Yeah.
And then you moved to Brooklyn, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you grew up in New York City, as did I, by the way. And mm-hmm. I understand you went to music and art high school there.
Yeah. With Eddie Gomez and Richard T. And who else was in that crazy homeroom class? Jimmy Owens, Larry Willis, Freddie Lipschitz, Al Foster.
Wow.
Bobby Colombi. It was a gang of us that did something really unique that doesn't happen quite often in most schools anymore today. We listened to the teachers, and because it was something... It was something in the milk, I don't know, but a lot of what I went to that school for was that my dream was to be a studio musician. Okay. Studio musician in New York meant everything from working on the Maestro Bernstein to playing Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus when you got the phone call from the union and said they need a drummer over at the garden because the other guy got sick.
Right.
And we said, who is playing? I said, the circus. Okay, where's the book? He said, no, I mean, you'll see it when you get there. What do you mean? Tonight, now, you know.
It's just behind the elephant.
475 different tunes in the book, and they're calling numbers. So that school was for that general kind of thing, where you went in and went, oh my God, don't let me mess up now. You know, somebody will fall off of a trapeze or something like that. I never got into that situation. It was just a few little tiny things that had to be done. But to witness it, and I was just there for hours, so didn't really catch a whole lot that was happening. It was more like I got a free ticket into the circus and a good seat to watch how the band functioned. Quick time, just in case something went down, because the drummer was ill. But it did open up my eyes. It was something I'll never forget. You know, I've been in those situations over years now, that or being at NORAD for a split second, to play in the Air Force Band because they were missing the drummer that had to play for the president or something like this. And so, boom, I was like the backup, you know, and heavy stuff. I wasn't ready for it.
Did you take lessons with any teachers in New York when you were high school?
Yeah, I did, actually. More of them more from the perspective of watching what they did. Mm. It wasn't because, well, probably I couldn't have afforded to pay for all of the teachers that I stole something from. Mm-hmm. to be quite honest, I probably wouldn't have had that money to pay them all at once. It would have definitely been on time, and I'd still be owing out something right now as I sit here and talk to you. But when you're talking of Charlie Persip and Elvin Jones and all of the people that were there, I was all eyes and ears. And to be able to sit in some places, I got a chance. I should say my mom got a chance to pass on some bucks. I think it cost us back then, $2.50 was a lot of money, man. And I had that money in my pocket, plus a kind of a lunch pail with some orange juice and a sandwich in it, because I was going to sit in on a Saturday afternoon in the summer while going to music and art, out of school then, going to music and art to hear an orchestra called Orchestra USA. And Orchestra USA was the orchestra that was jointly run by John Lewis and a few other, Milt Jackson, the MJQ actually was the rhythm section there. Gunter Schuller was a conductor. They were playing music by Charles Mingus, things, I mean, really, really outrageous things. But what they did, if they were working for a presentation in a week's time, they'd have maybe hypothetically three or four rehearsal days. And one rehearsal day before the show would be maybe a Saturday before they went to Carnegie Hall or to Judson Hall or something like that. And so it got them into promoting by word of mouth only the idea of having young people like myself who were known to them come in and sit in and watch and absorb what happens in the studio. They, at that time, and probably time generations before, understood that they had to be a model for us to get it. We come in with the idea as young people, naturally, we want everything like yesterday, and we're going to be the best that we can be, better than anybody older than us, you know, and God forbid anybody younger than us or our age should ever try to be as good as us in our own minds.
Yeah.
So we're legends in our own mind, and we come in, sit down. And they've been rehearsing, say, they bought the rehearsal studio for 9 hours with breaks. Okay, so three breaks, of course, gotta eat. They do their 6 hour rehearsal, but many of the students that are like myself who come in, and Barry Ashel and a lot of other drummers, who else, Steve Ellington, we all knew Elvin and all these different players. So they sent these guys in. They were preparing us for what we ended up doing later on in life, playing in the studio, playing big band, playing all these kind of things. It was a very special thing, but we had to pay for the last 3 hours of the rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And so there was 19 or 22 pieces in that orchestra. So there were, for each instrument, at least one student that had to come in. And in the case of the rhythm section, there were three drummers, young drummers. And what we did was those guys, after going to working for 6 hours, would sit down on a Saturday afternoon, and they became the audience for us. Oh. And what they would do is just quietly pack away things as we were rehearsing, because what was brought out to rehearse was the music of Gil Evans on the Miles Davis recording, Gil Evans plus 9, Miles Davis plus 19, or things like, just so that you were looking at charts that didn't have the name of the instruments on the chart. They had the names of the musicians who were going to play those instruments. At every station in the band. And it was not only Gil Evans, it was like, close your eyes and choose a chart. There was a box of Gil Evans charts. There was a box of Frank Foster charts. There was a box of Basie charts. There was a box, and they were all, or Dizzy Gillespie charts that came from like Dizzy's closet that sent down by taxi, just bang, and somebody would choose a chart, and then we rehearsed that chart. And the thing is for the drummers, because we were learning the sight read, which didn't mean that you had to play, they wanted you to make mistakes. You were never going to play that stuff exactly right. Even if you played all the notes right, there was just one element that was missing called feeling.
Yeah. Which
because we were 14, 13, 15 years old, 16, wow. Like this kind of thing. Just out of junior high school, stuff like that. And someone said, call this kid. That was how strong the being in the Apple was at that time.
Mm.
They were preparing us in many ways, not just to read the music, but they wanted to see even what time we arrived to hear them play. Would we be there if they called a session for 10 o'clock as drummers? Did we come at 10 to play at 10? Or did we come at 9 to set up to play at 10?
There you go.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And what did we come at 9 with to set up? What did we take direction? Did we go in when we heard Billy? Well, I was working under really good people, even at that time when with Grady Tate and O.C. Johnson, people like that, and they say, okay. Come down to this, we're rehearsing X, Y, and Z, you know. Bring some sticks or bring, you know, I like that hi-hat. They wanted to see if you could be depended on, be in the studio and do what you were told to do. And be prepared to have everything all set up so that you could start at 10. Or you start at exactly the time they said. Because the date starts at a certain time. No way am I going to be able to get in there 15 minutes early and play. No. So the whole objective is to get us young people to understand these things way down the road. So it's a habit already. A bad habit just doesn't exist. There's no such thing as that, because you were never late before. unless something happened along the road and you couldn't make it in, then you might as well go home. The day somebody else in New York, whether it was a bad thing or a good thing, unfortunately, New York was such cutthroat that you did not, if you were late, your job was taken. Somebody's waiting out the door. If you got there on time and you set all your gear up, next thing is you got to play. If you don't play it right, there's somebody at the door that's going to come and take your place, and the producer's going to say, thank you very, very much. Here's your W-9. You sign right here. Thank you very much. If I ever call you again, this is what I'd like you to do. You're gone. You know, and you might get the call or you might not get the call.
Right.
You know, because New York was, it was hard that way. So you came prepared to do whatever you could. It wasn't what you did on the bandstand, it's what you did to prepare to be on it. So that means if you're going to go do jingles, what's popular in jingles these days? So you're watching TV, you're watching an American Airlines commercial, Eastern Airlines commercial, National Airlines commercial, Mohawk Airlines commercial, you know, all of these, what are they doing, what are they doing? If that's where I wanted, where you're going to go. And music and art, that's where I wanted to do that. I love the idea of the challenge of going from like I said, from the circus to marches. So I was in drum and bugle corps when I was a kid, and I felt that I had a lot to bring to the table, which saved my butt when I got into the Army, because, otherwise I wouldn't have been in the United States Army Band. No way.
Bill, were you able to draw on the influence of the music of Panama that you heard as a child? Were you able to bring that in?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Why? Because I didn't know anything else. I didn't know what the name of the music was. I just know how it felt.
Yeah.
And so the reason why I'm here is because I received honors at the end of last month from the president and from the country. And so we did the whole thing dedicated to me at the Panama Jazz Festival for
A
whole week. So I had to do Spectrum 50, which is this year we're celebrating the 50th year. Spectrum 50th year of existence.
Wow.
So I guess it's more than 50 years, man.
Probably
about 70. You know, you look younger than you are. You were safe at 50, no problem.
Right.
And then so I did Spectrum 50 with Gary Husband and Rocco Zifarelli and Mike Mondesi. And then 2 days later, I played Tria de Panama, which is Alex Blake, who lives in Forest Hills in the United States, but he's a Panamanian. And Danilo Perez, who used to play piano with Wayne Shorter. So Danilo's the artistic director at the festival.
Cool.
And then after that was done, it was a kind of a combination of global, it's called the Global Jazz Orchestra, which is like a combination of New England Conservatory of Music people, Berklee College of Music people, and a lot of musicians down here from Panama, along with my horn band, three horn players, Michael Rodriguez and Brandon Wilkins, Marshall Jilks and trombone. I have a band called Time Machine. And so we're just ratcheting up what was done with my first band 50 years ago with Michael Brecker and Randy Brecker and John Abercrombie and all. So we're going to go back out. We're going to act this year. And so they were the ringers in the big band down here for the jazz orchestral thing that I did the day after the trio thing. And then in the day after that, I had to do 3 hours of lectures or 4 hours of lectures at the, what we have a campus, kind of a multi-educational campus, academic campus down here called the City of Knowledge. And so there's a school academy there. So we did that. I did that. But the UN is down here and all of that, UNICEF. It's all in the same place. So the week was a testing. It was a test. So here I am at approaching 80, saying, God help me, I'll never do that again. That was heavy. Yeah. But I'm glad you have made it through. Yeah.
Bill, when you were coming up, when you were getting better and in those young years in New York, surrounded by those drummers, did you have any favorite drummers that stood out to you that you looked up to or aspired to be like?
Grady Tate, Mel Lewis, Othie had already died. Grady, Mel, who else? Elvin, for certain things. My colleague, I could say that, he's a couple of years younger than me, that's Tony Williams, so we got on pretty good. Never saw each other very often. But can you imagine, it was a percussion center, there was a place called the Professional Percussion Center in New York City on 50th Street and 8th Avenue. All my friends, idols, colleagues, somehow made it in, you know, always there, or either there or Henry Adler's. And those were the two really important, for me, the two really important drum shops in New York City, for me. And professional percussion, you know, we all weren't working a whole lot. I was subbing wherever I could by then. This is pre-Mahavishnu, pre-Dreams, right around in there. So I'd go teach, and we had 6 or 7 different studio rooms. And then at least 5 of them was, along with me. One day I saw Papa Joe Jones working with his studio, with his student, Buddy Rich, on brushes.
Oh, my
gosh.
Wow.
And there's Max teaching somebody else. Max Roche, and then all these things, these places are soundproof, you know. So you got all this happening, and then down the next one would be Tony with somebody, and the next one would be who else was there at that time? It knocked me down, man. I couldn't believe it. But we had was it Philly Joe? Something like this. People were just studying all the time. We're only 2 blocks away from the New York 802 Union, where it used to be, in the Roseland Ballroom for years. So cats kept coming back and forth into that place. It was so close and unique. Or going over across town to around 46, 47th Street, Henry Adler's, and on 48th Street with Manny's and all these other places. But for drummers, those two places, as far as I was concerned, were rocking all the time. Until sometimes we weren't supposed to be open, and people were still upstairs and just studying or working with Al Duffy, who created the foundations for Pearl, and before, just around the time that I left to go with Mahavishnu, and Al made my drum set from a bunch of drums that were put together for me because I couldn't afford a drum set, so they took Zutty Singleton's bass drum and a Radio King bass drum that was not in a, it was in a fiber case that had a big hole in it. They took off the rims. They did a lot of stuff for me. And those in the days where it was about the love. Al Duffy was making timpani there by hand.
Wow, no kidding.
I mean, all of the materials would come in. And so it wasn't outlandish to think that he would think of, in the process, what would happen if you took the sprocket, the eighth sprocket, the smallest one on the bicycle wheel, and you put a chain on it and then hung it on a Gretsch, or because Ludwig didn't have a leather strap, and hung it on a leather, instead take the Gretsch leather strap off or the Camco leather strap off, and next thing you know, that's what you had your chain drive pedals. Mm. That was out of it, you know. And that was all done in the blink. Well, it would look like this, you know, click, 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 and the next thing you know, you got this thing, and you, wow, man, all you need is some WD-40, and you got something going, you know.
did you say the studio was on 50th and 8th?
50th and 8th on the corner.
Did you happen to run into a guy, Norman Grossman? Do you remember him?
He was the other drum teacher.
Yeah, I studied with him at 50th.
You know what I'm talking about?
I studied with Norman at 50th and 8th when I was in high school.
Is he still around?
No, he died about 20 years ago.
Good guy, man.
Yeah, he was a great guy. Great guy, yeah.
You know, we're talking about, we were kind of the next generation after the Saul Goodmans and all these guys. And so, I mean, from the classical side, I was with Goodman and Hinger and Mo Goldenberg was my teacher from Alitz. So I'm going back in that direction. I have drums from Billy Gladstone. Because his teacher, his student, Mo Lang, was a very close friend of mine, and he bought the rights to the Gladstone drum setup, you know. And so all of these guys were just one step ahead of me. And again, another influence would be Vic Firth, because he made my drumstick.
Right, right.
You know, so all of these things.
I love it.
I have to fall back on in terms of influences and what makes me do what I do now.
Billy, I got a question for you, if I could. In preparation, I've been watching some of the old videos and listening to some of the music and stuff that you've done over the years, and I always was influenced by, love the Drumming by Design. In that video, you talked a lot about your posture, how you sit, and you talked a lot about how mentally you prepare to play a piece of music. Mm-hmm. Could you go into that a little bit, like mentally, how you go into like really playing a piece of music and being in it rather than what's going on around you? Because that always intrigues me.
What I found about performance is that, as I said earlier, yeah, sight reading was one thing. Okay, it's good. It's like shorthand. But what's missing from that is the personality, the humanness of the mistake, or how to apply what you see in real time and get it right the first time. It's not always it can be, even if you make a mistake the first time, there's still the second time, as long as you remember where the mistake was. So you have minimum one chance to fix that. Even if you don't, at least you understand where you're going and why it didn't happen. So you want to make that adjustment. Mm-hmm. When I play, I'm trying to figure out which hand comes first, the right or the left. Because I learned by accident, to be quite honest, that one cannot just flow to the right if you have also an area in the left that needs attention. Mm-hmm. One has to flow from the center so you can give equal attention to both. Okay. You don't hear monophonically from the right side or from the left side. You hear from the center, and you hear stereo this way. So everything is still starting here. So no matter what you play from here or from here, eventually you should be able to emulate that from here, you see. Yes. and play. So even if it's weak, it will eventually get stronger. The more you, it first it has to start with a mindset. What am I going to do with this drum set? How do I want to present myself through it? A very dangerous question. Take some time, because now you're thinking not just playing here, how that sounds, which is already going to take a little bit of time, but how that sounds in relationship to the other sounds.
Right.
All these sounds going to go back, or it's going to be back, and so when you start to open up your drums in combination with each other, you got yourself an interesting situation. And so I'm saying that's one thing that you have to train your mind for. The only way to do that is to be able to sit in a proper position, at least for me, where it's comfortable. And since, excuse me, I like to eat. you know. So I like to sit at the table so I can get at the food in the most comfortable way possible so I can enjoy it. So, I mean, you know, the chicken. Okay, thank you. Okay, no, the mushrooms up here. Okay, thank you. You know. But what I'm doing is this. I'm not moving much more than that because everything's right here.
Yeah.
I got the best seat in the house. And that's how I'm playing drums.
I see.
Bill, not how your open-handed playing developed. You're the first drummer that I ever saw that played open-handed.
Yes. So, again, it's here. Thanks, Vic, for these. Because he plays a lot of things this way. Okay, and he will sit down. When he plays, I've never seen Vic Firth practice. Because he said, William, I practiced 50 years ago. What do I need to know anything? I mean, practice what? You know, most of the stuff that he played, he knew by rote up here. What we do, again, yeah, you read the music, but eventually you have to put that off to the side. It was just stenography. That's all.
Right.
I mean, just a shorthand. Now we know where we have to go. So we play. But you have to know where to hold the stick, when to hold the stick, depending on what you want to do. You know? So, match grip, yes.
Yeah.
Even in drum corps, you know, we play both ways. We were failures at it, but we had the direction we wanted to go. They were trying to get us to think stereo, not mono. Not in one direction all the time. Think in both directions.
It's like Gary Chester.
So you have your ride cymbal. How you play your cymbals is up to you. Again, you're the artist. So you can do whatever you want to do there. That in itself automatically sets you off from any place else, anyone else.
Nice.
That's tremendous.
Did anyone ever tell you that you can't do the open-handed thing? Did anyone ever dare?
Who was it? My dad took me to see Specs Powell, who's a good friend of his. My dad used to play piano in some places. And one of the guys in his band, his group that he's working with, said, you know, I know a guy that could teach Billy how to play. My father said, yeah, okay. Oh, what's his name? Give me your address. And I want to show it. Said, okay. Went down. I think Specs was playing in the original West Side Story, you know, with a teacher, I can't remember her last name now, the singer. And he was backing her up. I also did some work with Ella. And so he was teaching on the side. He came to town, and my dad said, yeah, I want to show you my son. He said, okay, sit him down, you know. He sat me down. He says, at his drum set, I could hardly touch. I was like this big. So I had to almost stand and forget trying to make the bass drum pedal go down. No, that's not going to work. So he said, okay, just sit here and show me what you can do playing drums. So I went like this. He said, no, you don't play drumsticks like that. I said, okay. He says, you play drumstick like this. I said, okay. So I then said, because I had to try to figure out, I needed for myself to understand why. Because I was already playing drumsticks, playing drums this way, and then I would play drumsticks in individual competition. Sometimes I do this, and then I come back the other way. And when he said that, I said, why? And my father said, because that's what he said you're supposed to do. I looked at him, I went, okay, I see where this is going. Let me just stay with this now. You know? And let's not, as my mother would say, just don't worry, it will be fine. And then around that time, my brother Wayne showed up. He was born, and he had, as little kids have, something equivalent to a maraca. You know, so it's like and it's all colorful and all of this. And he decided to take these maracas, these little light little things, and he's holding them, and he's having a great time because of the colors, and he's shaking them. And he's going through this. And I went, I wonder what would happen if I played it, the drums, like this.
Yeah.
Just yeah. One, you know, while no one was looking, you know, just to see. And what we have, all of us, is an imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And contrary to popular belief, if we're not playing in the band and we're not good at what we do, there's no band.
Right.
Right.
It's a cacophony of sound with no organization whatsoever. As right. soon as we go back, everybody goes, wow, the band sounds good. Yeah, drummers don't write music. Drummers don't play music. Uh-huh. But drummers do this. Back. Then the band sounds good. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And it goes on like this, and you just go, that's not going to change. That's a marketing ploy. We are the band.
Right.
Put us and the bass player together on any given day, and as long as the bass player and the drummer listens to each other, you don't need anybody else. Everybody's going to be doing this.
Yep.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I think that it's wonderful that you open so much stuff up like that by using your imagination. That's why I asked the original question. Mm-hmm. You know, and looking at some of your old drum kits, you can, mm-hmm. I can tell from what you just said that you're thinking that way because, yeah. like you didn't have the 6-inch tom up to the 8-inch tom. You mm-hmm. had things going this way. There'd be a big 14 over here or something mm-hmm. like that, And I also noticed your tuning on them. I was talking to Jeremy about that before we got started. Man, you would play and those drums would sing. You had them pulled up nice and tight. They really sung, man. Sounds fantastic.
Yes, and there's a reason to have, not to get the tonal character from a drum. It needs to be either, it depends on the situation in which you're playing. John Blackwell was the first person I saw with a drum, a tom-tom that was actually squared in a circle. It was 8 inches and 8 inches. It was 10 inches and 10 inches or something like this. And everything was like, come on. This is, I shouldn't say that. That's not, some of those drums weren't even, he didn't have an 8. He had a 10 at the smallest, a 12, by 12, 13 by 13, and that kind of was it. You know, then the tom-toms came and they were kind of the same, 16 by 16, and you go, oh man. That's one character, but when you hear him play, when you hear all the, when he does touch a drum, because a lot of the times he was twirling his sticks, okay? So it was again, one step closer to Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus at the drums, you know. Bang, bang, that was fun. Wow, man, I saw John play. Mm-hmm. And many times I say to myself, well, what did he play? I mean, bass drum's going, or one bass drum going, excuse me, double bass drum pedal. It was his style. I didn't hear the tonal character of the drum. Okay. When you add for me, good example, Bubingas, and I have a set of natural wood Bubingas, pure Bubingas, and I requested and bought an extra set of toms that were 2 inches deeper than the ones that normally would come with the drum because I wanted more tone from the drums to go with my 22 inch bass drums. Okay. Or even 24s, depending on whom I was working with. Dimensions mean something.
Yes.
Okay. And so if you can, you don't necessarily have to change or go to a deeper tom, but if you know something as an alternative about drum heads, you might come up with a combination that will suit what you're looking for with the same cylinder, but you've got a thinner, more responsive low head that against a double mono thickness on the top. Depends. It can be the two companies I know best, of course, is Evans and Remo. So therefore, they've got it all. Somewhere in the middle of all that, I think, I mean, I'm able to work with. Again, it depends on the music that you're playing. So you're not a rhythmist. You have to be a highly imaginative musician,
yeah.
An artist who's thinking, okay, I'm playing this kind of music. This is the groove. This is how I want to set things up. Do I need a heavier pocket? What size snare drum am I going to use? Can I get away from me for musical purposes, a 5.5, just because, you know, again, the drums in different dimensions. And all of a sudden you come up with something nobody else is doing.
I think this is a really critical piece of being a really good musician as a drummer. And it's something that's lost on a lot of beginners, understanding that you're not just contributing rhythm, you're contributing sound, you're contributing color, and you're contributing mm-hmm. texture.
Yes,
and
sir.
So much a big part of how the music sounds is how you sound on the drum, not just what the pattern is, but how you make that happen. And so much of that comes back to what you're talking about, the sizes of the drum, the heads you choose, the tuning, the sticks you use. And that's just becomes your personal expression, you know?
Yes. They can't play themselves. You know, when that happens, I'm running in the opposite direction. Now really ghost, you know, but you have to have some reason to do what you do.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be a whole lot of notes per bar.
Right.
It just has to be the right notes at the right time.
Well, this is a perfect segue that you mentioned that. I wanted to ask you about playing with Miles and a tribute to Jack Johnson record. And that, I wondered about how that tape came together and whether there was charts and whether you were thinking about density and all that stuff, how much direction you got from Miles, or was that just completely organic off the cuff?
So the night before the recording,
I feel actually like a fly on the wall for the first time ever. I'm all ears.
So I got a call that morning. Yeah, hello. Come to rehearsal tonight. Okay, you at home? Yeah, 6:00. He hung up on me. Okay, so I never got a chance to say anything more. He didn't ask me if I was available or not. He just told me to come. Of course, I'm gonna go. I'm not coming. I wasn't doing anything that much except for trying to find something else to eat. So I went downtown, and I was on 86th Street. I think he was on 79th Street or something like that on the west side off of 11. Got there. McLaughlin was there. Michael Henderson was there. Who else? God, man. Grossman was there. McLaughlin, Michael. Nobody was there. There was no piano player. There wasn't. It was just John. That's right. That's interesting. Because the piano player did show up later. But for all the wrong reasons, which is awesome. So I had this drum set that Duffy made for me that I thought, I was always trying to figure out, man, how can I use public transportation to get to the studio? So I needed a small drum set. And so I had this 18 by 12 inch bass drum. So it was 18 inches in diameter, 12 inches deep. I had that in a trap case I think. And I kept my cymbals, hi-hat cymbals, my cymbals in the case as well. I think it was an old fiber case that Mel Lewis gave me or something like that. I didn't have any money. I was trying to figure out everybody's panhandling and just trying to make something work. And next thing you know, I had all this stuff and I could take all of that for to go downtown from 86th Street, make the crosstown bus. I could make it for about 50 cents, you know, on the bus, but I had to send the money up front with somebody to give this is the public transportation bus, put it in the thing. And I'm sitting in the back with my drum set, get down to 54th Street and Park, go upstairs to Studio 4. And we had rehearsed a little bit the night before. Something I just saw go by my head, which was like 8 notes on a piece of paper. It was like a composition paper from school, you know, in a composition notebook that you wrote notes in school. And it was like 8 round notes that diagonally went down across the page. That was it.
Wow.
So I'm saying, like, I don't want to say anything, so I'm not going to say anything.
this is the first time you'd ever worked with Miles at this point?
No. But it's like, you know, I did 5 albums with this cat, at least. And that has come out, and there's some other stuff that has not come out off the hook. But that's who it was. So I said, look, just shut up, don't ask questions. Pay attention. So Miles at rehearsal before I go onto the studio says, I need a groove. I said, and I'm looking at him, just, okay. I said, play something with the groove. Okay. So I played something and he said, that's it. I said, okay, remember that tomorrow. I said, oh shit. So I didn't close my eyes because I had to look like I knew what I was doing. So I said, okay, of course tomorrow comes. And we set up and everything. And Miles says to me, we're getting levels. And we're just sort of playing around. Miles says, okay, that's it. No playing between takes right now. And he goes into the control room, and he's talking to Tio Macero and the engineer, Tom. And they're not coming out. It wasn't that long, maybe 5 minutes. All of a sudden, McLaughlin goes, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. We're just sitting. I mean, nobody else is playing because he said not to play. But John started playing this. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And it's a blues. I mean, you just, in between the notes, nothing's happening. But we knew where it was going. Next thing you know, Michael Henderson, and he's just improvising. And it's on a blues bass, and it's called. And I mean, it felt really good, you know. I'm just saying, I'm watching everything else. It's a saxophone player. Oh, yeah, well, Steve Grossman was there, that's why. So Grossman's there. He's still not playing. And I'm saying, it sounds good, you know. Next thing you know, it got to a point where it was now guitar, bass, duet, and they seemed to need some drums, but I don't know, my hands started moving. And all of a sudden, I started playing on the snare drum fast and sort of lightly bashing, just playing a little bit. And it's starting to get very intense. And Miles comes up and says, I told you not to play in between takes. Everybody stop. And he walks back in the studio. Next thing you know, Michael Henderson says, you're not going to tell me when I can play and when I can't play. So now, everybody knows that there's a history with these cats, and you know, it's like oil and waters. But Michael's an unbelievable player, and Miles puts up with all of this. They got to work that out. That's not, So we're just trying to stay here. But Michael starts to play even more intensely, and John, just smiling, starts to play again. You know, and he's smiling because now it's a don't play. When you're not looking, I'm going to play. Because John had this idea, which ended up becoming something we did with Mahavishnu and also something that was done with the Tony Williams Emergency Band. Mm-hmm. And it was just something that had developed out of there. So, but who do we know? I'm not thinking that way. It's coming, you know. Next thing you know, my hands really started moving. And, you know, next thing you know, it's going. And it's like roaring. And Miles runs outside and said, red button. And red light goes on, bang. And that's how Jack Johnson was created. Wow. And the heavy is like, while all this is happening, because obviously he didn't know, Herbie Hancock walks in. Mm-hmm. That's where we got a piano player from. But he walked in with, I think, at least two bags of groceries. Because he was going home. So let's give him one bag of groceries. And in his other hand was a record called Fat Albert Rotunda. It had just been released on Warner Brothers because Herbie had just gone from Columbia to Warners or Blue Note to Warners. And I'm watching this, and Miles turns around to him and said, play. And he turns to him, yeah, dark glasses, and play.
Yeah.
Herbie's looking and said, No, I just want to leave the record, man. I just want to put this down in the record. But play. and meanwhile, the band now is roaring, you know. And there's this Farfisa organ that hadn't looked when Herbie actually put his fingers on it, dust flew up in the air, I guess, out of frustration. It hadn't been played in years, you know. And when they plugged the thing in, it went. You know, and all the stuff came out the back of it. And that's what you hear. All this cryptic stuff going on Jack Johnson. Herbie's trying to figure out what to do with this thing. And eventually he puts both forearms on the keyboard. And wow, because he's, you know what else to do with it.
Oh my God.
You know, I'm the fly on the wall. I'm watching this and saying, no one's going to believe me.
Right.
I'm still playing. I'm just, I'm going, I can't believe I'm watching all of this go down, you know. I can't stop now. So once we finished that and they faded out, Miles then comes to me and says, you remember that thing I told you to play yesterday? And of course I'm like, mm-hmm. He said, play it. So I start to play something. God, I try to imitate Bernard Purdy, somebody, anything. But I don't remember anything. You know? Wow. You see, listen, I mean, again, it's like these laser eyes going through dark glasses, and like, he says, "What? That's not what I told you to play yesterday." But I like it. It sounds good. I went. Lesson learned.
So we got to ask you, because we're running short on time, but I have to ask you about Mahavishnu and Intermounting Flame and how that record came together and your musical contributions as a player and also, you know, arrangements and composing. Tell us about that experience.
In essence, I was making a movie soundtrack, again, subbing for Grady Tate, on a movie soundtrack that was created for, oh man, it was a Sean Connery movie, and Quincy wrote the soundtrack. And Grady got sick and couldn't make it for the first 3 hours. So what I had to do was fill in for him, and of all people to be in the rhythm section was McLaughlin, as one of four guitar players that were on this record, on this soundtrack. when I finished working with John, he said to me, can you help me out? I need to play. I have some stuff I'd like to check out. That was very, very, you know, just an easy thing, because we were all into jamming and helping each other out down in the village. A lot of musicians that lived on the west side from 96th Street all the way down to Greenwich Avenue. And when we could, we would just go hang out, take everything, go over to somebody's house and play a little bit. And this particular time, he said, no, I want to do something. I'm going to just put something in the studio. We'll book something down around Green Street. There's these lofts that were technically kind of mildly, you shouldn't be working in them. The elevators didn't really work that well, blah, blah, blah. So ended up finding a place. He did. It took us about, and he'd say, just in this little notebook that he had a theme, I guess, because he'd remember and he'd just start playing this theme. He said, what would you put to this? And it happened that way. It continued to grow about 5 or 6 days later. We would do this, play each day, I'd say, with maybe a break for a sandwich, we'd easily put in 6 hours a day. Eventually, in 2 or 3 days' time, we had some patterns that he liked. And for me, it was school. It was just about studying and getting better. And what a special way to do it, but to just have drums and guitar, that's all. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we were building on a foundation, a template that was eventually going to add more instruments. I had no idea at the time where this was going. None, zero. I hadn't thought about it. Maha, who? I had no idea what the name was. There was no name for a band. We were just playing this music. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, Jerry Goodman shows up. And I didn't know who he was at all, because he was just not in my in my social environment as a musician. So I didn't know I didn't know anyone in Chicago, much less me. I mean, except for when Dreams went there, we played, and we hung out mostly over at Beavers, a place called Beavers, where Tower Power, a new young band, was just coming together. And Doc was there, and we all had a great time, and we hung. But that's about it, you know. So we continued to work together, John and I. Jerry came. Then we made a recording at Hendrix's studio called My Goals Beyond. And that was with Charlie. I can't remember Charlie's name. Of a bass player and from Ornette Coleman's band, Charlie Hayden, and who else was in that band? So it was like the four of us when we made this record. And we were at Electric Ladyland for that. Next thing I know, about over the weekend, Jan Hammer came.
Wow.
And he had finished working with, he had committed to making, joining the project. And he was working with Sarah Vaughan prior to that. And so then we started to get to know each other. Everything felt pretty comfortable. And the last missing piece was Rick Laird, who was isolated on a ship. He was in the middle of the Indian Ocean, heading south to Australia, moving hook, line, and sinker, everything from England there. And when he got the call, he had to figure out a way to get off that boat and get back to New York City, not England, because he signed out of England. And the next thing you know, wow. Yeah. And that's how all of that came together. So that's a little time left. I mean, there's more. That's an outline.
I can imagine.
In the session itself, were there charts or just sketches or just stuff you'd rehearsed?
Never wrote a note.
I never had
a chart to read. No, none.
Wow,
that's
That's cool.
What an incredible story. What a fantastic story. I've
got one quick question, and maybe the guys have something too. So we'll go over a little bit just because there's so much to ask you about. Who are some of your favorite young drummers today?
Some of my favorite, I got to tell you, I don't have any favorites. And it's difficult to say. Young for me would be Dennis Chambers. But it's not. You know, okay? So that's where I'm going for young. Anything prior to that, or Will Calhoun, if you notice,
oh yeah,
I don't know if you've ever seen on YouTube, I've got a 5 drummer presentation where the young drummers are Dom Famularo, Dennis Chambers, Will Calhoun, and Gary Husband, and me. Uh-huh. You know, and I invited them to play on a piece that I wrote called Cuba on the Horizon, with the objective being interpretations by people who are one generation or my generation or a generation after me. Mm-hmm. And from that's where I got stuck on. The reason? I've been working a lot, and it's partially out of desperation because I don't have management or anything like that past what I do with my family. Mm-hmm. So we find little bits and pieces and we continue to focus on the brand, making the brand better. It's not about competing with anybody else.
Right.
Because the one thing in my mind is that if I play well, there'll be something to do. Mm-hmm. But that means I have to sustain myself. I have to play properly. I have to be respectful of the template. I need to be there on time. I need to have people whom I can trust, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So it's a sensitive, fragile kind of existence based on trust.
Mm-hmm.
But if it works and everything is in place, if we play well, that's my theory, my axiom. You play well, everybody in the band with you presents a unified presentation, chances are more than 60%, you're going to get something else.
Yeah.
So you work a lot based on that premise. And by the way, it's about handshake. We're going to be here. We're going to be there. This is what your fee is. We agree. Boom, let's hit it. You know, let's have the fun for the day is playing the gig.
Yeah.
Everything else is cool.
Yeah.
And so I don't get a chance to watch a lot of other people play, especially if they're younger than me. Because if they're younger than me and they're on the show, they're more than likely they're opening the show. And you know, I'm snoring someplace in the corner.
So you would say even after all these years of doing this and being in as deep as you have, it's the same thing. It's the same premise. Show up on time, be ready, be trustworthy, play well, show's over, right? I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same advice.
Absolutely. The problem is that talk is cheap.
Right. Know? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You do it and nobody will forget you for it.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on. I mean, I have a great friend. I still to this day consider him one of my closest friends that I never see. And that's Jabali Billy Hart. I rarely ever see him because he's working someplace else.
Right.
He's in Cleveland or he's there. I mean, I just hear about him. Meanwhile, we've known each other for over see him on the walk, a moving walkway in Seattle Airport or something like that. Said, yeah. Hey, what's happening, Mason? Yeah, right. You were going to call me. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was 20 years ago. I'll call you tonight. Uh-huh. Same phone number? Uh-huh. Okay. 30 years later, right?
You know Lorca, his son?
No.
Oh, so Bill, Billy Hart's got a son, Lorca Hart. He's been on our show. He's a very dear friend of mine. Amazing jazz drummer here in the Bay Area. Yeah.
No. Anyway. You guys are in the Bay Area.
I am.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because I lived in Mill Valley for about 10 years.
Oh, no way. God, how did I not know that? when was that?
From 1972 to 1982.
Yeah, I was still a kid in New York at the time.
The only reason why I bring it up is because, I mean, the kid that I worked with mostly in that period of time was a young lady named Sheila Escobedo.
Oh,
and she lived in Oakland.
Yeah.
With her father and mother, and she was just, you know, everybody's record, you know. Mm-hmm. That was it, you know, at the time. But they were playing East Bay funk and Latin, you know. I mean, that whole thing was happening in that particular way, and I was part of that, you know. Cool. And that was the tower. Everybody was there, man. You know, that was what was happening. So, yeah, it's a different kind of world. And then I moved to Europe. Another story for another day.
Yeah. I feel like thank you so much for all the stories and sharing all your great wisdom and experiences with us. I feel like we still just scratched the surface, man. We'd love to have you back on again sometime.
Yeah. Okay. Give us a call. We're around. No problem. Great.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, Bill, thank you so much. This has been a real treat, and I meant what I said. I felt like a fly on the wall when you started talking about Miles Davis. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, this is all legendary. So so great. Thank you so much.
Oh boy, yeah. Yeah. Close that door. Don't even let the fart come out, man. That's a whole other thing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Man. You heard it here first. Miles Davis farts stank. Okay.
I didn't say anything.
All right, man. Well, thanks again for everything. Okay. And we're big fans of yours and your drumming. And thanks for everything you've done for all these years, man. I appreciate you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Be well.
Thanks so much. All right.
That was amazing. Everybody, thank you so much for watching. We went a little bit over, but that's okay. We're still live.
And thank you for 150 episodes, everybody.
150.
Oh, and before we leave, we want to mention that we are officially planning our second Deck Day event. That's going to happen here in the Bay Area on April 20th. And we got a studio already set up. We got all sorts of stuff going to be happening. Lots of giveaways from our sponsor companies. Mike D'Amico from Brooks Drums is going to be there with some drum kits and some snare drums. He's going to show off. Jason Slota, who's been on our show, is going to be there from Round Sound Cymbals, going to talk about how to choose cymbals. And they're going to have four clinics with the four of us and lots of giveaways from our sponsors. So April 20th, Chip's going to put the link in the chat for the event. You can sign up. And we hope to see you there. It's going to be a super good time, super fun.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Billy. Wow, what a treat for us.
Thank you to Kelly Ray Tubbs.
Thanks, Kelly.
Yes, thanks, Kelly.
Kelly, if you're watching still, thank you. This was very cool.
All right, you guys. Thanks for tuning in or sticking with us. We'll see you all next week.
See you next week.
Time, everybody. Thank
play
you.
Us out, Rick. Play us out.